Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Lob Podcast. This week we are covering the philosophies of football. These Football Times, the magazine, is coming out with a new edition next week that is talking all about the various philosophies of football. So we have four authors that are in the magazine to help us get through this topic, hopefully in an hour today. We first of all, from Manchester, we've got Dan Williamson. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Jim.
From Parts Unknown, we've got Gary Thacker. Not sure where Gary is today.
I'm still in England at the moment, Jim. I expect to be going to Spain in a couple of weeks, but I'm still in England at the moment. So good evening, guys, to everyone out there.
And joining us, as usual, is Mr. Stu Horsfield. Hello, Stu.
Hey, Jim. Hi, guys. You all right?
It's good. It's all good. And rejoining us on the Lob, finally, after many months, I've missed him. He's my old podcast partner. I love him to death. He's my main man, John Townsend. How are you, John?
Jim, I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm trying to avoid the 95-degree heat here, but that's okay. I've got the air conditioning cranked. So we were talking before the podcast, and a really good topic was La Nuestra. And Dan has created a really good article about La Nuestra. He's an Argentine football expert. So, Dan, why don't you kick us off with a little bit of that philosophy and just kind of get us rolling here.
Yeah, sure, Jim. And that's actually quite a good starting point. We had a question as well on Twitter about that by Tom Evans, whose handle is @BaristaAtWar. And he asked, when did it stop working and why? When did it stop working? You could actually point to one specific game, the 1958 World Cup, Argentina's first game at that World Cup. 1958 was Sweden, if I recall rightly. They got beat 6-1 by Czechoslovakia, which sounds like an absolute crazy score. And that was the turning point, really. So the three decades before, just in a nutshell, because it's a fairly complicated topic, but Argentina was isolated politically and on the football field, and it created this sort of perfect storm, the isolation did, where they had some of the, the most stunning, attacking football that you could imagine. But the downside of it was that they didn't evolve. So they didn't appear at any World Cups between 34 and 58, partly because of World War II, but also because they didn't qualify or they didn't actually take part in qualifying. So this isolation just created this, I don't know, I guess you could say they didn't evolve at all. So in the meantime, other teams were playing each other, they were learning from each other, they were changing formations away from the classic 2-3-5, and they were becoming more savvy tactically, they were becoming fitter, more streetwise, and Argentina were just, I guess you could say, by the end of the 50s, just becoming a little bit naive. It was all, it was all beautiful to watch, easy on the eye, more about entertaining than winning. And in that sense, they'd just been left behind, really. And the legacy of that was that the clubs and the national team became a bit more negative. It became all about winning. And, the domestic league, you started seeing attendances drop and the teams became a lot more sort of what you'd call anti-football. There's so many instances in the 60s and 70s of Argentina's national team and the club sides being involved in all sorts of brawls. There's quite a few classic instances in the Intercontinental Cup against European teams. Celtic in 67 is one where it just descended into a mass brawl, really. And that is a direct hangover from this period.
So what do you think about, do you think La Nuestra lives today in any way, shape, or form, or do you think Argentina is developed more like world football.
Did you see the World Cup? I don't think there was anything.
Hey, I'm the one that predicted Iceland would draw with Argentina. So you can hate me all you want.
No, Jim, I'm happy for you because I know you won a few dollars. I actually predicted Messi to be the top scorer. I think I was going with the heart rather than the head. I think, you know, Argentina has, over the last few years, it's well documented how the national team has been failing. This steady supply of number 10s that was seemingly endless has seemed to have dried up. And, I mean, look at the squad at this World Cup. It's so basic compared to previous squads. It's not very inspiring, and there's just not really any standout stars. Is they take away Messi, and you've got a few guys that are aging that were part of the successful under 20 teams 10, 15 years ago. But apart from that, the well is, you know, it's run dry really, and I can't see any excitement out there when it comes to the national team. But it's a complicated situation. Doesn't help that the domestic league is not particularly vibrant at the moment, you know, with the economics over there. So, no, I don't think there are any real remnants from that at the moment, to be honest.
Very good. So, Stu, let's talk about your piece here for a minute.
Really?
Yeah, I know.
Okay. I had the misfortune to look at the English long ball philosophy, something that has very much been to the detriment, I think, of the national game for a long period of time. Essentially, it has its roots way back, in fact, with a former wing commander in the RAF who took his notepad and pen to a number of professional games and concluded that the headline findings was that 80% of goals come from three passes or less. And then from there was born the idea to get the ball forward as quickly as you can, as near to the opponent's goal as you can, and try and score. And that was it. And then that work was picked up on actually by Stan Cullis in the 50s on his side. And then with the sort of the advent of Manchester United's success in Europe, obviously England's success at the World Cup, George Best, and it tended to die out. And then obviously Charles Hughes, anybody who's done their sort of coaching badges or is of my generation will know that Charles Hughes was the FA coach educator for a number of years, 70s and 80s, and wrote a couple of books, The Winning Formula and Soccer Skills and Tactics, which essentially took on Reap's work and sort of further promoted this need to essentially bypass the midfield and get that ball forward as quickly as possible. In fact, Charles Hughes' quote, "The strategy of direct play is far preferable to that of possession football." And I think it's that philosophy. And I think there's a generation of coaches out there who learned that philosophy. And I think it's starting to change. But certainly that philosophy of getting the ball forward as quickly as you can, getting the ball into your opponent's penalty area as quickly as you can, had a massive, massive detrimental effect on the game in this country. And we were chatting before. I think that was probably further exacerbated with the Heysel Stadium incident and the banning of English clubs in Europe. We became, a bit like Dallas talked about, very introspective. We were sort of in splendid isolation. We had to create our own competitions. We weren't competing in Europe, and we just continued with this system and this philosophy of play, which, you know, we're starting to change now. You know, the FA have started to change with their DNA program, and hopefully bringing it right up to date with Gareth Southgate and what's gone on with the junior teams and the men's senior team at, you know, the World Championships and the World Cup. Hopefully things are just starting to change, but it wasn't pretty research, you know.
Yeah. So Dan, what do you think about that?
Yeah, just one thing I want to say is I've had this discussion quite a lot. I did my first coaching badge last summer or the summer before, and this was not, you know, this Charles Hughes bloke wasn't mentioned at all. So I think Stu's right. You know, they're trying to move away from this now, and the coaching courses have become a lot more modern, and you know, there's a lot more focus on letting the new coaches create their own sort of pathway rather than, you know, here's the pathway you have to follow. And you know, here's a book full of drills that will help you sort of go along this pathway. It's more letting people be a bit more creative and individual. So a lot of things that the FA do wrong, and even with the coaching badges themselves, but I think they have made huge strides to try and change that.
Speaking of coaching badges, John, you've had your share of time in the barrel with coaching badges. Also, I know you wrote an excellent piece on Total Football for the magazine. What are your thoughts? Do you bring the Dutch way into your coaching?
I try to. I think it comes down to what you're dealing with at the present moment. So when I have here in the States, when I coach what we call academy grade players, so players that have serious professional prospects, hopefully. You definitely try to bring in some of the elements on both an individual perspective and also expanding into the team dynamic. So, you know, you want all your players to be able to interchange. You want them all involved. You want them to be flexible. You want them to be confident with basically the principles that Total Football requires. You know, you want them to have the ability to play one or two, even three positions, receive the ball on either foot, be able to play forward, be able to pressure cover and provide balance. But when I try to coach some of the elements, it really isn't something I can just say, well, we're going to do Total Football today. It's more going down to the 1v1 level. Are they able to compete? Are they confident 1v1? And then 2v2, 4v4, 7v. So it's almost like you have to make it at the micro level with your instruction to kind of get some of the principles of Total Football across. And really, one of the things that people look at, especially here in the States, but other places as well, is they see Barcelona, they see Ajax, they see some of the most fluid, dynamic, and explosive interchange at the highest level, and they think it's just something they can train in a session. And really, that's not what you train. You train the elements that bleed into that or build up to it. And so I'll tell you this, in all my coaching courses, Total Football has never even been brought up. There's never even been mention of it. I think people try to move away from that label, and I think it's more about the modern game is very dynamic and fluid and flexible. So that's kind of what people are trying to get across. They don't call it Total Football anymore in Holland. It's really something that I try to celebrate the past, you know, with what Cruyff and Mikkels and even, you know, the Austrian Wonder Team and the, you know, and some of those great teams in the 30s, 40s, 50s did well before the Ajax Revolution of the 60s. I try to celebrate that through my writing, but when you talk to players and coaches today, it's really something that I haven't found. There's a lot of people who know much about it beyond the buzzwords. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense to me. You know, you and I have had a lot of discussions over the years about Total Football and Catenaccio. And, you know, which philosophy do you think sort of won in the end between those two that were competing so feverishly for world football domination?
Oh, I think if you really look at it in terms of accolades, defensive Catenaccio type is probably going to get more results. The classic case is the 1974 World Cup, where, you know, Netherlands are steamrolling. They're playing this vibrant brand of football. And then, you know, they come up against West Germany. And West Germany finds a way to problem solve and negate the effectiveness of Cruyff. They negate the fluidity and the interchange, and it's really this case study into how to basically beat Total Football with tactics that not only are good themselves, but also introduce, you know, the role of a sweeper and some of these other things that pretty much don't really buy into what – so Total Football wants you to chase. They want you to try to – they want to move you around defensively. They want to condense the pitch. They want to spread you out when they have possession. And in the end, I think pragmatic, disciplined, and defensive football has always won out. I mean, even this past World Cup, I don't know if you gentlemen saw the same thing I saw, but the idea of possession and out-possessing a team really didn't work as well as – it has in the past. I think if you look at World Cup in 2010, maybe 2014, maybe the Euros in the past with the Spanish teams, they definitely had some of these elements. But the Italian teams and some of the counterattacking teams, I think, have always been more successful. And that's kind of one of Holland's biggest blights is they had nothing to show for Total Football in terms of winning something.
Yeah, we... You know, in our podcast on the World Cup, we went into great length about, you know, just how frustrating it must be to be a Netherlands fan, you know, getting to the wedding but not being the bride, you know.
Well, there's this great great essay, actually by Terry Mickler, about the 2010 World Cup, how Spain beat Holland playing a Total Football type of brand. And we call it tiki-taka. They call it whatever they want. But really, the principles were set in stone in Spain by a Dutchman. And then over the years, the maturity of it, the maturation process, and then the end product was this World Cup final where, you know, it was a great World Cup final, but Spain did something that the Dutch would have wanted to do. And then you saw the Dutch revert back into, you know, trying to kill Xabi Alonso in the midfield with a kung fu kick to the chest, and they became more physical, and Spain just kept passing around them. And it's a great essay. I got to remember what it's called, but I think it's How Spain Beat Holland Playing the Dutch Style or something like that. I'll send it to you, Jim, but I suggest checking it out. But it's a really ironic case.
That'd be great because we love Terry Mickler. He's one of the greats for sure. But
yeah.
So let's bring in our man, Gary. How are you, bud?
I'm good, Jim. Thanks, buddy. It's a fascinating conversation just listening to the guys talk. And first thing I'd like to say is a massive thanks to Stu for taking the bullet that all the rest of us tried to avoid. When our Mars
decided,
we're hiding behind our desks, and Stu must have peeked out and got nailed.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's also great to hear John talking about Dutch football. I know he's an expert on that, and the subject I wrote about was the Libero, which actually probably informed Dutch football as much as it informed Catenaccio. And the great, this sort of weird thing about Dutch football and the total football era of the Cruyff, Neeskens, Ruud Krol, that sort of arena was, I think they hadn't qualified for a World Cup for about 30 years, reached two successive finals, and then never qualified for the 12 years. Talk about burning bright, but burn short. You know, Total Football is a great example of how philosophies, tactics develop over time. And the subject I wrote about, the Libero, I think was a good example of that. Obviously, going back to the days of Karl Rappen and the Swiss team of the 1930s, who were revolutionised by this new idea of playing a guy behind the back four, who could then be the guy who collect up and tidy up behind the guys. But not only that, but also to initiate attacks by surging forward and creating gaps in the midfield. And how successful that was. And being on the Swiss amateur side, who played 1938 World Cup, did really well, only lost eventually to the eventual finalists, Hungary. After the Second World War, his philosophy was taken on by a number of different people in so many different ways. So we had the Grand Inter team of Herrera, who almost abandoned that forward thrusting element of the game, and with the player he had at his disposal, Pichi, who became almost the ideal sweeper, non-aggressive sweeper, and was the formation of the Catenaccio style of play. And then with the Dutch, you had players such as Barry Holzhoff, one of my personal best favourite footballers of all time, an amazing player who I always say he strode about the pitch with socks rolled around his ankles, with that broad red stripe on that white shirt, like some giant out to correct the wrongs of the footballing world. Outstanding player, and really fit into that Libero situation. Then later on, you had the developments of Franz Beckenbauer with the West German team. But Libero isn't just about the defender, it's not about that player, it's about how setting up a team with that player influenced the rest of the team. And as John was saying about how tactics and philosophies developed, so it became, the role almost became split between a number of players. So you had like a Claude Makélélé, who was almost the sweeper in front of the back four, who was there to sort of tidy up, play the short pass to get moves going forward again. And also the sort of sweeper-keeper situation where the guy who was behind the back four tidying up for mistakes and errors wasn't an outfield player, was actually a goalkeeper. And how these sorts of setups of a team allowed different parts of the other elements of the team to be set up in different ways, freeing players to do different roles. And it was one of the successes of the great teams of Barcelona in semi recent years, where they had a midfielder, Mascherano, deployed as a defender. And it echoed what the Dutch did in the World Cup in West Germany, whereby they had Barry Hulshoff was injured, so they couldn't play him as the libero. So instead of playing another defensive midfield player alongside the young Reusbergen, they opted to shift Harry Hahn back from his midfield position into that libero role. And so it didn't disrupt their total football philosophy. And I think really the libero thing that I wrote about, as the more and more I got into it, I could see how this was like the root seed for so many different football variations of the same philosophy developed from that innovation.
Yeah, well, I was always a big fan of that position, you know, obviously being a Calcio fan myself, you know, and it was used so heavily there that I always loved to watch, you know, some of the old games with some of the guys like Fracchetti and some of those guys who really dominated from that position. And I don't know if you touch on any of those guys in your piece.
I absolutely do. As well as Fracchetti, there's Soria, Bergnich. I'd say to go back to the Grand Inter team of Herrera with when he had Peach playing for him. I mean, this team were dominant in the era. They won two Scudettis, I believe, two European Cups, Continental Cups, Intercontinental Cups, I should say. They were really a dominant team, and that's an adaptation of the philosophy of the libero that Herrera was allowed himself to deploy in Serie A. It was revolutionary, and it set the pattern for so many teams going forward, and still exists to this day. You know, Catenaccio the Bolt is just the same, is the different translation of the Veru that Rapan introduced going back to the 30s. And how that situation developed, where are we now? So some 80 years ago, still has echoes now in the way teams are served. But I think it's a fascinating thing about how football develops and evolves. So, and it's a respect to that philosophy that was first created all those years ago.
So who do you think right now is playing the libero position that you watch today? I know we had Claude Makélélé, who invented the Makélélé position, which was really a libero. But is there anyone in the game that you really enjoy watching right now?
I guess the simple answer that I'm sort of resorting to type a little bit here is N'Golo Kanté. If there's a guy who picked up the mantle of Claude Makélélé, it's this guy, and then added something else to it. But there again, he plays in that situation in front of the back four. It's a shield, but it's also he sweeps up in front of them, and he provides the impetus for attacks as well. I mean, this guy is massively underrated as an attacking player. When you see him pick the ball, it happened quite a few times in the last stage of the World Cup for France, that he gained possession and ventured forward and kicked off attacks that France profited by. And I think it's that ability there that he had to not only inherit Makélélé's position, but also develop. There's a great example, as I say, is how libero thinking has gone forward. The other element, I guess, of it is perhaps also with the French team is Hugo Lloris. He's a classic sweeper-keeper. And that the French back four can push forward, knowing that balls over the top of him, over the top of their defence, will be intercepted by the goalkeeper, who's always playing almost on the edge of his penalty area. And it's how the role has been a split between a number of players, and the French World Cup winning team are a really classic example of that.
That's great. So, speaking of this, We've got one more question from Dan. Dan, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Gary on that subject. Do you think that sort of a legacy of that position, that idea, is, do you think that when we're looking at sort of modern day, what you'd call modern day centre halves, you know, the likes of John Stones or David Luiz a couple of seasons ago, do you think that's a sort of a legacy of that position, you know, ball playing centre halves that are quite happy to, I mean, not technically sweepers, but they're quite happy to sort of step out of the defence with the ball, you know, going back a bit further, Rio Ferdinand as well?
Yeah, I absolutely do, Dan. And I've actually mentioned Rio Ferdinand as a player who would quite easily fit into that sort of mould and that role. Certainly David Luiz. And strangely enough, I mentioned John Stones in the most of the closing paragraph of the piece. About my theme is, this is a quote from Thucydides, who said, "The secret to happiness is freedom, and the secret to freedom is courage." And having that ability to have a player, that confidence, that belief, to have a player who can bring the ball out from the back, creates so many opportunities for players moving forward. Harry Maguire in the World Cup, who, not known in English football for being that, but Southgate had him, gave him the confidence, or had the confidence in him, that he could bring that ball forward. And him moving forward into midfield creates so many gaps and opportunities for the midfield players. And I think somebody like John Stones would be ideal in almost a classic, a Rapen-inspired libero role, because all the abilities are there. A little bit more experience, a little less sort of naivety sometimes, perhaps. But yes, Rio Ferdinand, John Stones definitely would fit that role.
And John just piped in saying Leonardo Bonucci as well, so which is a good shout.
Absolutely right, John. Of course, yes. I mean, obviously, I'll just sort of focus on a few English examples there, but I'm sure there are lots of examples across the continent, and in fact, across the world, where similar sort of players exist with that sort of ability.
You know what I found interesting, and from afar, was you get beyond the, in this World Cup, you get beyond the, you know, the memes of it's coming home. But I actually was really refreshing to see England play a certain style where they had ball playing center backs, they had players willing to step in between lines receiving, and then actually just dominate in one on one situations. I mean, I think it was a really telling sign that I think the game is evolving, and where coaches like Southgate and others are giving players license to do some of the things that obviously encapsulate probably all of our philosophies that we've talked about, but just this idea that flexibility, versatility, interchange, dynamic play is now becoming hopefully the new standard, especially for a country like England. I think, you know, when I look at my upbringing in the game, I had a lot of British coaches, and it was very direct, very, you don't go outside of your lane, so to speak. And I saw something different with this England team. And I know that there's probably a lot of buzz about it still. But did you gentlemen see that from your perspective, that you had players that were all comfortable on the ball, that they were all willing to press as a unit, they were all willing to do certain things that we maybe haven't seen traditionally out of sides like that?
I would say that, I mean, and I think the system we played with through the back also allowed that to happen much more. Both our fullbacks, especially Trippier. Trippier was one of the, this guy can't even get a regular first team game for Tottenham. He just plays some first team football, but he's certainly not nailed on regular. And the players Southgate selected for the team were obviously people he thought would fit the pattern of play he wanted to deploy for England. And I think confidence in the ball and ability and confidence to take on the responsibility in one-on-one situations, as you mentioned earlier, was very significant. And what the other guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because Dan was chatting about the coaching badges, and I did my level two a couple of summers ago, having done a level two about 15 years ago when it was a slightly older delivery method. But agreeing with Dan, the new coaching badges are, you know, they're great the way they, like Dan mentioned, it's about trusting the coach, I think, to work with their players. You know, and now they have this, well, they call it the DNA, but it's, you know, England have now sort of formulated this root system that they want to, that permeates at every level of the game, you know, within England, right from, you know, the young national teams right up to the senior teams, you know, in academies. They want this England to create this new identity and this new DNA that they keep talking about, this process. I mean, we're only sort of 4 years into it, but already with the under-19s, the under-17s, the under-21s, and, you know, now with Gareth Southgate and the senior team, like I said before, we're really starting to see, even in the space of 4 years, that this philosophy is starting to be embedded in it. And it comes from, you know, trusting the coaches, but the coaches trusting the players as well. And not, like John's just mentioned, you know, formerly England coaches were very rigid and this is your position and don't do this and don't do that. It's now all about, can you do this? Can you do that? You know, can you exploit space? Have you the courage, like Jim said, to be able to take the ball out? And it's almost giving the players more responsibility, more decision-making responsibilities. And I think from that is coming this almost like this new brave era that we're starting to see, you know, in English football, which, you know, for me is, being an England fan for the last sort of 35, 40 years, it's refreshing to see for the first time. I'm quite excited about England and England national teams going forward, and not just the senior teams, even looking at the junior teams and how they're doing and how can that be integrated into the Premier League, which is, you know, a whole other issue and discussion. But, you know, can this DNA philosophy be taken into club level? Can it be taken to grassroots level, you know, which is where we'll really see the game thrive?
Those are great points. Thanks, Stu. I wanted to leave plenty of time because we did get a lot of user questions this week, and some really good ones that I think we can really sink our teeth into. So I'll go ahead and read the first one, and then I'll get you guys to react here. But Lindsay McDonald, who's at sports_Lindsay, asks a great question, which is, how much focus, if any, should coaching philosophy go beyond the remit of developing and teaching technical football skills and tactical ability? And then she says, for context, I work for a charity helping young people get jobs and develop life skills using football and new sport England strategy. So maybe, you know, Dan or Gary, maybe you can chime in on that, since it's an England-focused question.
After you, Dan.
No, I think that's a really fascinating question, and I assume what Lindsay's sort of referring to is the personalities and the characters as well that are trying to be developed as well, because I think behind every footballer that there's a human, and I think there's been a lot of focus in the last year or so on mental health as well. So I think it's really important that, and I do think that the academies are trying to do a lot more work with that nowadays to make well-rounded individuals as well. So it's not just about the football, it's about the education, and it's about giving them life skills as well. So, you know, if football doesn't work out, they've got something to fall back on. But, and I think if we're talking about England, me personally, I fell out of love with the England national team for about 15 or so years. And I wasn't sort of jumping from the rooftops this time, but what I will say is that it was so refreshing to see a squad and a manager that was, you know, eminently likeable, really. There wasn't one player that, normally there's three or four players that I can't stand, but in this squad, they were all, you know, likeable characters. And I think it's that humility that's been lacking over the last few years. And I don't know, perhaps that's, you know, perhaps Southgate has purposely gone out for those kind of characters. I think that's really important.
Yeah, picking up on that, I'd agree with everything Dan said there. I'm of the particular vintage that when I did my first couple of coaching badges, I also got Mr. Charles Hughes's book given to me as the book that of all with no wisdom. And I was once told by one of the guys running the course that when I sort of questioned it reasonable, in a fairly reasonable state, I think, that the reply was, do you want to pass this course or not? But there was just the beginning of the, it's more than just about football, with sort of childcare and that sort of thing being sort of introduced. Now, I'm, from what I hear, this is increasingly the case with people being told that this important part of coaching is not just coaching the skills, it's coaching the individual and developing the person as well as their skills. So yes, I think the answer to the question is it is a really important part, that the development of the person is just as important as the development of their skills. Because as Dan mentioned there, you see the joy, and I think that's the right word, the joy that some of the England players had playing for their manager was a massively encouraging thing. Something that's been sadly lacking, I think, in English football for a long time. You get certain managers of clubs who rule by fear, and I don't think that helps that much. And I think the development of the person is really important. So I absolutely agree with what Lindsay said.
That's great. Do you have anything to add, John? I know you know you spend a lot of time with youth players yourself. So
I'd just like to echo the points these gentlemen made, because so often we focus on the player, not the person, and do want to develop obviously the person as well as the player. But I look at some of the cases of some of like the great players of the past who are now either selling their medals or they're out of a job or they're you know on hard times, and it's like they didn't have, once the football was gone, they didn't have life skills. They didn't have, it's almost, they revert back to a childlike state. I mean, I think in England you probably have the Paul Gascoigne story or some of the other ones, but I think in just in terms of this World Cup, people were talking so much about just what happens to former players when the final whistle blows and they have to move on to something else, and some of them never even get to that upper echelon. And there's so many academy players, so many youth players that aren't given some of the basic skill sets because they've devoted so much time to sport and they don't understand. And they don't understand what life dynamics are coming their way if they don't have the game. And I think modern coaching courses, the role of player development from a, I would say, federation level, but it really does have to tick this box, and it, for years it hasn't, and I think it's getting much better, especially here in the States. But the reality is we have a massive gap between in the US. We have this very much winning first mentality, learning second, and I think that drives players out of the game in any sport, but in this sport in particular, I think it's very important to address things like mental health, especially for male players, mental health, depression, you know, anxiety. All of these are extremely important, and I think even the introduction of a sports psychologist and having somebody to talk to about performance and stuff outside the game as well. But I think it's all incredibly in development now. But I'd love to see this discussion in 4 years' time. You know, how this becomes a facet of academy football or grassroots football. Really, this is the standard. We have to develop the person as well.
Stu.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, obviously, you know, everybody's pretty much covered it, but working as a teacher, sometimes we use football more as a tool. So obviously guys have talked about, you know, academy players and former pros and stuff, but sometimes we experience it whereby you might have kids who are very, not average, love the game, but maybe don't play for a team, don't even play at a grassroots level, maybe don't have the opportunity to do it, but love football so much that you can use the game as a sort of tool to develop those as individuals, be it through maths and English skills, employability skills. And I think the game is a great carrot to draw those people in to maybe develop their personal skills. So rather than making them more technically proficient players, what you're probably doing is making them maybe more employable, maybe, you know, sort of improving their education, but football is the key that you use to reach those people. And certainly for us, you know, working in a sort of an inner city college, it's what brings those students in. And I think football is great for that. And I think the coaches who work in those environments probably have different priorities to maybe coaches who work with teams or in academies and stuff. And like I say, I think that's the beauty of football as well. It reaches or can reach so many people on so many different levels.
Great point, Stu. Thank you. So we have another question here from Mark Neal, Mark_Neal70. And I like this one because this fits right in our swing here. Should a coach mold his philosophy to the players at his disposal or mold the players at his disposal to his philosophy? And I think we're going to see, and this is a point I wanted to bring up with you, Gary, I think we're going to see what Maurizio Sarri does with this very question at Chelsea this year. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim. I think Chelsea are almost a classic case in point for this question. So obviously, Antonio Conte came into the club 2 years ago with a set idea of how he had achieved success in Italy. And after a few games, saw that this was the way to go. Changed the entire philosophy of the team, and not just the tactics, the entire philosophy of the team. And shaped it to his way of playing. So very much took the view of making a player fit his philosophy. Won the league title almost at a canter. And it fell apart, obviously, the following year. But that just shows how it can happen. And I guess it's all about sort of flexibility. Mourinho did it slightly differently, because when he took over the team the first time around in 2005, he actually bought the players in that would fit his philosophy. So he actually made he achieved a squad amendment that would fit what he wanted to do. So Chelsea are a really good sort of example of this sort of thing. I guess another coach who had a similar sort of effect was Ancelotti. And again, a guy who'd had amazing success in Italy, primarily with Milan, adapted the team to the way he had been playing. But he had the right tools to make it work. Now, whether he would have changed his philosophy otherwise, it's difficult to say because it never happened. But I think Chelsea are a really good case study for this sort of question. And I think the answer to the question that's been posed is it all depends. I guess coaches will want to take the course of least resistance. So if it's easier to mould your philosophy to the players you've got, if you can't change the players, that's what they'll do. If it's easier to do the opposite, that's probably what they'll do, because, as I say, it's the course of least resistance in the final analysis. That'll probably be the action they'll take.
John, do you have anything to add for this?
Oh, this is a good one. I've been to coaching courses and I've met coaches, and I've actually thought this before, where it's, you know, players fit systems don't fit players, and there's all this there's all these debates. I find that the modern player is actually more adept and versatile than perhaps we give him credit for at most levels that I've experienced. I think coaches trying to implement philosophies on a squad of players that have a set way of playing, or maybe it's like in Chelsea's situation where they got a new manager now. I look at Liverpool, for example, the identity and how it takes probably iterations and almost years to roll out a new philosophy, or a philosophy that is going to eventually be the standard. And I think it takes an incredible amount of patience, incredible amount of I would say taking your losses and learning how to roll out a philosophy. But at a club like Liverpool, for example, Klopp has that license. I don't know if at a club like Chelsea, Sarri will have the time that Klopp's had to eventually get what he wants in. It's taken years and years. It's like three years in now. But yeah, it does come back to this debate. Do players dictate systems or vice versa? And at the level that I coach, I try to make the system, capture what all the players can do. I very rarely, if ever, change how I play because one player doesn't fit it. So it is kind of a tricky thing. But I'd be interested to see what other coaches have to say about that.
Stu, do you want to get in on this question?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think Gary's quote sort of sums it up perfectly, the path of least resistance. I think time is the enemy of philosophy. Managers now are given so little time, unless they come with, a massive reputation to be able to, embed their philosophies. Obviously, Guardiola's, the great example. And I think it's Kyle Walker who's, put a tweet out, every day is a school day, and obviously there at Man City, certainly, Guardiola is putting his philosophy, it's the blueprint, his stamp is all over Manchester City. It was all over Barcelona. It was all over Bayern Munich, and it's all over Manchester City. And he's the sort of manager who will be given time based on his reputation. Sarri at Chelsea, you know, I'm not so sure. You know, if he doesn't get off to a rapid start, there's no Champions League football, so they'll be expecting domestic success. And I think. Unfortunately, it's time. I think we talk about philosophies and players. I think time now in the modern game has become the third crucial element to that question.
A couple more reader questions that you had. So
we did indeed. The first one is from Mr. Andrew Flint, who we know very well. He's a senior writer for these Football Times. Last seen, dotting around Russia in his car. But he has had the time to send a question in to us. It's a great question, I think. Do the panel think that it's dangerous to delve too deeply into philosophies or other footballing cultures when trying to revitalise one's own football? Before I bat it over to you guys, I'll put a couple of points across for this. I think the answer is probably yes and no. I think it's great to pick bits from other cultures that you like, but it has to sort of match your own identity as well. You know, you can't copy other cultures. You can take the best bits, but not copy. I saw a couple of funny things on Twitter over the World Cup, and it was when Spain and Germany went out, and it was just basically saying, you know, England have been talking for the last however many years that, you know, we have to be like Spain, we have to be like Germany, and then before you know it, they've been dumped out of the World Cup. So I thought that was quite interesting. So I don't know what you guys think about that one.
I'll jump in if nobody else is going to say anything first. I think the answer is you should always look at other opportunities to what works in other places doesn't always work where you're going to be. But great opportunities are sometimes sometimes revealed to others first. And we've spoken about how philosophy has developed and. Dan was talking about the Argentina and the isolation, how that's sort of happened, which I think is the exact opposite of taking ideas from other people and how English football stagnated during the post-high school years. I think English football and any football, be it club or national team, can learn from others. And if you close yourself down to the ideas that other people are using and often successfully, then you're perhaps closing yourself from ideas that might work for you. It doesn't mean you have to take everything on, but it suggests that you probably should consider everything that's out there.
Yes. I'll chime in real quick. In the please. States, we like to do the copy and paste method, which is we don't have an identity because we're such a melting pot of so many cultures. But I think we haven't qualified for this World Cup. We don't have a national team coach on a permanent basis. We've just undergone a very painful election for the president of our federation, and in American soccer history, and other countries may relate to this. We have hired and contracted the French Football Federation to do one thing. We've contracted the KNVB to do another thing. We've enlisted the FA to send resources, and so we've definitely reached out as a culture. However, we don't have this one thing in place, which is the culture to actually have implementing some of the things that have worked or not worked. And another good example is the Dutch. You know, they haven't qualified either. Do they blow up their system? Do they tweak it? And I think you don't have to look very far to see how other countries borrow from one another. And I think, you know, the first point that was made was very simple. It was very good. Is, you know, simplicity is probably very you know, the best way to do it. But you also have to understand that just doing what Germany does, just doing what Spain does, it's not just a one-step thing. And I think in my country, Jim and I can attest to this, it's almost as if the assumption is just do what Iceland's done. Just build mini pitches. Just do what, you know, Spain's done. And it's not just one step. And I think we sometimes on the surface feel that the it's almost like the approach is too simple. Like it's a multi-year, decades-long approach. And I think, you know, everything has its life cycle. And Germany's is going to be under question now. Spain's, obviously. So it's a great question, though. It's a fascinating question. I don't have an answer for it, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think any of us really has an answer to that one, but that was a valiant effort by Al. Dan, what's the next question you have?
Hi, Jim. Yeah, of course. It was a question from Jose Luis Rodriguez. He's saying, do philosophies overcomplicate football? So I don't know what you guys think, Stu.
That's a tough one.
It's a great question. I think we're using so many different terminologies and things get thrown out on the television. You know, you have tactics, strategies, philosophies, football culture. We have all these interchangeable terminologies and, you know, we never really sort of nail down what each one means. And you're left with this melting pot of assumptions that this means this and this means this, or that philosophy might mean something different to a different person or even to a different country. And it's a really difficult question, as in, does it overcomplicate? The beauty of football is it's an incredibly simple game. There's very few rules to it. It requires very little equipment. And it's almost it's made complicated by this people looking for a magic formula that maybe isn't there. It's about playing the game. It's about enjoyment. And yes, when there's so much money involved, there's, you know, professionalism, and it needs to be taken seriously. But I personally think the game at times is very overcomplicated by people who maybe either shouldn't be involved or don't need to be involved at certain levels. And I think that, for me, in terms of philosophies, I think that's the problem, is what do we actually mean by that terminology of philosophy? We've used it a lot tonight, but what does it actually mean? And I think if we can nail down what it means, then perhaps we can discuss whether it overcomplicates football. Granted, I probably just overcomplicated the question. I appreciate that. But it's something to consider.
It's an interesting question, and I think you know, the points you've made there are perfectly valid. Personally, I would say no, it doesn't overcomplicate the game. It actually uncomplicates the game, if that's actually a word. Because obviously it's about a belief system, and if you believe in a certain way of playing, other things follow from that. Now, that's not uncomplicated. It's not complicated matters. It's actually unpacking things a little bit and making it less of a confused morass of opportunities. If you believe in a certain way of playing, certain things will, tactical approaches will follow from that. So I think a philosophy, and it's a good point you mentioned, Stu, about the definition of different terms, be it formations, tactics, or whatever. But I think all those are things that are hung on the structure of a philosophy. I've just actually, whilst he was talking, I've just punched up the definition that it says, and it's a theory or attitude that acts as a guiding principle for behaviour. I think that's probably exactly what I mean by it when I say that it guides the sort of way you want to do things in life generally, and particularly in football. So to me, it unfogs the question of how you're going to play.
Thanks, Gary. I knew you'd be able to help me out.
I just picked up the ball, mate. You played the ball across. I just picked up possession, buddy.
Lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, just one point I want to add is, in terms of complication, I think often you've got coaches who can overcomplicate things. Louis van Gaal at Man United a couple of years ago, he allegedly was you know, stifled the players, and they had all these different instructions, and in the end what you saw was players, you know, creative players just at the wit's end, really, you know, forced to pass it sideways, and there was no kind of cut and thrust, there was no excitement or anything, and they'd been drilled, you know, within an inch of their life, this is how we play. And sometimes it can, I think like Gary says, sometimes it can sort of teach players that this is how we want to play, this is what we're doing, but other times it really can stifle players. I think Mourinho is probably not too dissimilar, really, that he has his way of playing, and it's, you know, my way or the highway. It's not allowing players to go out there and express themselves using the best of their ability. You see it a lot with over the last couple of years at Man United, with the wide players, that they've seemingly been instructed not to go past the fullback. You know, in the classic old style winger, it's always the guys who are playing out wide. They get the ball, they get wide, and then they sort of cut back inside, and they go backwards for the safe pass. So I think sometimes philosophies can stifle creative talent.
What do you think, John?
I'm just looking at this Cruyff quote, and I think the game is too evolved to be as rigid as a philosophy. And I once did a keynote speech on this about how when I first stepped on the field as a player and I walked off the field as a player, and many years later, was I the same player? Obviously not. Same as coaching. When I first learned how to coach, did the formal process, then the informal, like, you know, here's how you set cones out and all this stuff. I never asked myself what was my philosophy of coaching, like, before I went to that first coaching class. And now, you know, it's changed. It's always changing. It's really something that the game is very simple at the root of it all. But again, I think if we look at, you know, the way you want to play, what does that end product look like? And I think the steps to get there are always the complicated part. So does philosophy complicate the game? I think it actually simplifies it. I agree with everybody else. I think it actually does give you an arena to play in instead of just looking at the game for, you know, 22 players on a field. I think it's more, this is what the goal we're working towards. And it's like education in so many ways. There's no one way to define it. So that's something that I've learned in my experience in the game, and I'll continue to learn and relearn.
I want to thank everyone for being on today's LOP podcast, and we'll see you all next week. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The LOP, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.